Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
The FT.
Why are high street banks so keen to talk about investment bonds? What has the Investors Chronicle learned from 150 years of writing about shares? And when is it safe for property buyers to think about new build homes again? Answers to all of these questions to come in this week's FT Money Show. I'm Matthew Vincent, and I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with my colleagues from FT Money, Alice Ross.
Hello.
And Tanya Poley.
Hello.
And our special studio guest, Claire Barrett of Investors Chronicle.
Hello.
So let's start with the money news. Last week, Santander, the banking group that took over the customers of Abbey, Alliance and Leicester and Bradford and Bingley, announced that it had entered an exclusive agreement to sell Prudential's investment bonds in all of its branches for 5 years. And it's not the only bank to offer these insurance company bonds to high street customers. Co-op and the Royal Bank of Scotland sell them too. But in recent days, financial advisers have expressed concern over the suitability of these bonds for basic rate, higher rate and non-taxpayers. One went so far as to describe the Santander move as a recipe for mis-selling and yet another clear example of commissions and commercial pressures standing in the way of common sense. Alice, this is pretty strong stuff. Are these fears justified, do you think?
Well, it's probably not fair to say that Santander is going to be mis-selling things before it's even sold anything. It's not starting to sell these bonds in its branches until next year. And when it does, you know, I'm sure that they will tell us that they're taking all appropriate steps to make sure they're giving the right advice. That said, investment bonds are... financial advisors increasingly saying that investment bonds are just not that suitable for the majority of investors, as you say, be it basic rate taxpayers, higher rate taxpayers or non-taxpayers. That's basically everyone. They're just not very suitable investments anymore. They're a little bit outdated.
So let's just recap on what they are exactly. If you go into Santander or Co-op or RBS, any of these banks, and someone says, would you like an investment bond? What are you being sold?
You're being sold a product that is offered actually through a life insurance company. So it's actually an insurance contract. Not to be confused with your normal fixed rate bond that you get in a bank, which just offers you, you know, 3% cash or whatever. So it's an insurance contract. But what it does is it wraps up other investments within it. So usually you'll be offered access through the investment bond to maybe 10 other funds, maybe 50 funds. It depends on the product that you're offered. A lot of these funds will be managed by the life insurance company. Some may be managed outside of the life insurance company, but it's basically a way of putting a lot of equity investments in one place.
But it's the tax issue that seems to be causing all this consternation. So how are these bonds taxed?
Well, they're unusual compared to other forms of equity investment in that investment bonds are taxed as income, not capital gains. So if you own a unit trust or an investment trust shares, then you pay capital gains on that when you sell it. When you sell an investment bond, you pay income tax. So that creates its own problems. With investment bonds, 20% income tax is deducted at source. So if you're a basic rate taxpayer, you don't have to pay any more income when you cash it in. If you're a higher rate taxpayer, you have to pay a further 20% or 30% if you're at the new 50% rate. And if you're a non-taxpayer, it really wouldn't make any sense at all because you would have paid 20% income on something when you don't even have any income.
Yes, and if you're paying income tax on the gains you make, you're not getting to use your capital gains tax allowance of, you know, £10,100 a year.
Exactly. That's why for most basic rate taxpayers, it might sound good because you don't pay any extra income tax, but you're not using your capital gains tax allowance that way, unless you have a significant portfolio of other shares that are taxed as capital gains, but it's unlikely.
Now, these are onshore investment bonds, but some other advisors have been recommending offshore investment bonds to certain of their clients. Are there concerns about these as well?
There are concerns about these as well. They tend to be more recommended to higher rate taxpayers. So if you're being offered an investment bonds as a higher rate taxpayer, chances are it'll be an offshore one. Now, offshore ones offer certain additional tax advantages in that they allow the investments in the investment bond to grow free of tax. So that can be quite a good deal. And if you're a higher rate taxpayer now, when you buy the bond and you're going to be a basic rate taxpayer, for example, in retirement or later in life, that can also be a good deal. But offshore bonds are also, you know, questionable by financial advisors. What some companies are now doing is they've basically devised this technical way of shifting the tax from some of your offshore bonds to other bits. So the bonds can be cashed in parts. And what they're doing is saying, well, if you want to cash in your bond, why don't you cash in 3/4 of it this way? And then we'll move the growth onto the bit that you haven't cashed in. And so you avoid paying any tax on it when you cash it in. But it kind of sounds too good to be true. And some advisors are just not recommending these kind of bonds because they say, well, this is the kind of thing that the revenue could definitely clamp down on.
So you need to be very wary if you're sold both an onshore bond and an offshore bond, it sounds.
Yes, in summary.
Well, thanks for that, Alice. And for more on the pros and cons of these two types of investment bond, look out for Alice's article in FT Money with this weekend's FT and online at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, are new build properties a better bet than period homes? First, though, a rather special anniversary. This week, Investors Chronicle magazine celebrates 150 years of reporting on events in the UK stock market and offering share tips to private investors. It started life back in 1860 as the weekly Money Market Review, merged with the Investors Chronicle and Journal of Finance in 1914, and was taken over by Brendan Bracken, the man behind the modern Financial Times, in 1928. Then in 1967, Investors Chronicle merged again with the Stock Exchange Gazette, and in 1978 it became part of the FT Group. Some of the legendary journalists who have worked on the title over the years include Harold Wincott, Andreas Whittam-Smith, Lucy Kellaway and Robert Peston, and, of course, our special studio guest, Claire Barrett, who has just edited the 150th anniversary issue. So, Claire, having just emerged from the dusty archives, having done all your research, what are the lessons of the last 150 years of history?
Well, Matthew, I should point out, a fellow legendary editor of the Investors Chronicle from a few years back, surprisingly, the lessons learned from 150 years are that we haven't bloody learned any of the lessons. The first ever issue in 1860, which somebody fortunately had a photocopy of, sadly we don't have the original, it got a bit lost, was a very interesting document to read. The three top stories in that issue from 150 years ago were a warning on burdensome government debt. Nothing's changed there. A scandalous banking anomaly, which had come to light, making people fear for their savings. Well, you know, 150 years later, we're still reading from Northern Rock and Lehman Brothers. And finally, an article about the worrying state of Turkey's debt, most of which was held externally by British investors, whereas today we obviously have Greece, which is troubling us. So not a lot has changed, but there are some useful things that we can draw on the lessons of history. Notably, my challenge to our associate editor, Dominic Picarda, who's our resident pointy head, you could say. And I said, Dominic, can you find out what £100 invested in the stock market in the 1860s would be worth today? Now, he scratched his head a bit because there wasn't an index that you could follow back then. It was all a big mess with thousands of companies dotted all over the place. But he worked out from academic records what the rough line would have been. Then he joined us up with the FT30 index, which started in the 1930s, and then finally with the FTSE 100, which started in the 1980s. And he came up with the answer. Would you like to know how much £100 is worth?
£100, over 150 years of, well, series of bull markets and bear markets. I don't know, I've got no idea.
Well, the answer is about 12 grand, which I thought was fairly piffling, I have to say.
I thought it was
going to be a lot more. And I said to him, well, why is it so low? And he said, well, that's not accounting for inflation. And also, it's purely capital growth of that £100. It doesn't account for, A, the dividends you would have received, or B, the impact if you had reinvested them again and again into the index. And I said, OK, well, what's the real figure then? And he gave me one of those looks. So, but, I mean, you could speculate and say, you know, would it be £1 million, would it be £2 million? I mean, the lesson that history tells us is start early with your investments, keep going with them, keep reinvesting the dividends, take advantage of compound interest, and eventually you'll have a nice little nest egg, but it may take some time. And looking back over the performance of the markets, that red line, which is in the bumper issue, there are periods of 20 or 30 years when the capital gains, the capital returns, hardly do anything at all. I mean, for most of the 1970s, it was, you know, dead as a dodo, completely flat. But then you have a very short window where the performance goes bonkers, as in the 1980s. So set over a long period, the stock market, you know, was far superior to property, bonds, the gold price even. But it was often down to a very short period of outperformance rather than a steady drip, drip, drip of growth.
So that leaves the private investor then, I suppose, having to decide whether or not to try to time the market and capture these sort of short bursts of sudden growth, or whether to just go very, very long term, you know, longer than these 30-year sort of plateau periods, so that you have time to, you know, to make some money.
Yeah, and I suppose a sensible approach would be to try and go for some long-term investments and some shorter-term ones that you think are going to drive a return. I mean, another kind of interesting social point that we could make is in 1860, the average life expectancy was 40 years, so retirement provision was nil because most people just died, whereas nowadays, in the course of our publishing history, the life expectancy of the average Brit has doubled to nearly 80 years. So, you know, we've got even more need to save and make wise investments. So I would say you've got to have a long-term attitude, start early, and keep a copy of the Investor's Chronicle at your elbow to come up with some share tips every week that might make you those short-term gains.
Yes, I thought you might be able to put in a little sales pitch there. Just finally, you know, in the course of all the research that you've done and looking through these old photocopies, I'm sure they didn't have photocopies back in 1860, but are there any particular things that stand out to you? Are there any particular sort of former members of staff you've met who, you know, had great insights?
Well, I've got to mention Robert Peston. I was so wonderfully surprised. I sent him an email a few months ago and said, it is our anniversary and we'd love to come and interview you. And I've heard from John Plender on the FT that Peston started off as a cub reporter on the IC in the early 80s. And he emailed back straight away and said, oh, you know, you must come in and I'd love to talk to you. And we had an interesting chat. And I said, well, what articles do you remember writing, Robert? And he did a cover feature in 1984 all about women's clothing, which I found very amusing. We actually did manage to dig it out of the archives in the Guildhall Library in the city. Very kindly opened their archives to us. And he'd written about this new contender on the high street in the early 80s called Next, which, of course, a very big company today, and how they were taking on the dowdy Marks and Spencer's brand and appealing to Ms. Yuppie, which Robert explained is a horrible American catchy but appealing term for describing young upwardly mobile professionals of either sex.
Did he put a buy tip on it?
Yes, he thought that Next did we're going to do very well, and I think he's been proved right on that. George Davies at the time was the joint managing director. This was in the days when British companies had managing directors rather than chief executives. It was before the great Americanization of the boardroom, and I think he did very well there to write about a subject that maybe the IC readers of the 1980s were not perhaps quite au fait with.
There you go. The IC always one step ahead. We certainly like to think anyway. thanks for that, Claire.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to read more, the is it 144 pages of anniversary
the whack factor?
Yes, exactly. Listen to how heavy that is. Of anniversary issue is on sale now, of course, in all good newsagents, featuring interviews with, as Claire said, Robert Peston and other luminaries, including John Bogle and Jim Slater. You can also read Claire's analysis of investment returns over 150 years in FT Money this weekend. And finally today, new build property. Empty new build flats in the city centres of Manchester and Leeds came to symbolise the bust that followed the recent buy-to-let property boom. According to the Nationwide House Price Index, the average UK house price was 8.4% off its peak at the end of the second quarter of 2010, but 12.1% off its peak if it was a new build property. But these lower prices have now been attracting greater demand from owner-occupiers rather than speculators. And Savills reports that owner-occupiers accounted for 84% of all new home sales in the first half of this year. So, Tanya, it looks as if new build property prices are set to recover. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, we had this very different situation at the peak of the market in 2007, where actually there was this kind of huge oversupply of new build property. I mean, mostly, like you mentioned, the city centre flats and obviously some new build homes as well. And that kind of led to lots of problems with overinflated prices. And there was this kind of this new build premium where actually, like, over the course of during the downturn, we've obviously seen that premium eroded, which has actually helped first time buyers and kind of just sort of normal buyers as well, to be honest, because now prices are a lot lower. And actually, because a lot of the stock that was kind of coming into play, that's actually been put on hold. So we're actually not even seeing that much stock of new build properties coming through. So what we are seeing coming through tend to be the more successful ones and kind of better quality, which is actually attracting owner occupiers more rather than investors. So I think if this limited stock is going to continue, we are actually going to see prices kind of continue to rise, and probably, obviously, like we mentioned, they're like lower than sort of the second-hand market at the moment, so they've got kind of further to go, really.
And is it mainly houses or is it flats and houses? Because of course, all of the speculative building of these city centre apartments, with hindsight, now looks like a busted flush waiting to happen. But is this more across the whole market?
I think the prices from the Nationwide House Price Index, that's obviously kind of the average, so that's probably new build properties, houses as well as flats. But obviously the houses are doing better than the flats because there's a bit more demand for them. But what we're actually seeing is that it's a lot more kind of deals that house builders and developers are offering on kind of the new build flats. So they're actually kind of, we've got a situation where obviously mortgage finance across the market as a whole is very limited and very restrained. And it's especially the case with the new build market because lenders are still very wary following that kind of boom and bust that happened and this overdevelopment of these flats. But I think for first-time buyers that are keen to kind of get a one, two-bedroom property, these new build flats are actually providing quite a good deal because, I mean, we've got Barrett Homes this week that's come out with an extension of their Head Start program, which is actually offering... basically, they provide a 15% loan, interest-free loan to the buyer, which they have 10 years to pay off. And this means that the buyer will actually only have to put down 5% deposit and then get an 80% mortgage. So it kind of makes it that much easier for them to actually get onto the ladder because most lenders at the moment aren't really offering. It tends to be around 70% loan-to-value for flats or 80% sometimes, slightly more for new build houses because they're a bit more happy with those. So we're seeing actually kind of a lot more developers come up with schemes that can actually help first-time buyers get onto the ladder. And because the prices have fallen so much, owner-operators are quite attracted to these deals.
And I suppose we've seen this week that the first-time buyer numbers are still very low. In fact, they fall again this week?
They've fallen again, yeah.
So this is one possible way in which a first-time buyer can get some help to get on the ladder.
Well, new build property tends to be the easier way for first-time buyers to get onto the ladder now because of these deals. I mean, the second-hand market, you still would have to pay a bigger deposit. And obviously, it's in developers' interest to get more people buying their properties. So it's providing a better deal. I think we need slightly more innovation in the market. We need a few more house builders and developers to actually look at doing similar deals. Earlier this year in June, Bovis Homes linked up with Woolwich to offer a 90% loan-to-value deal on there if you buy a Bovis home property. And that was kind of introduced with this, they had this kind of insurance indemnity thing set up with Woolwich to kind of let them, well, to encourage them to actually offer these 90% loan to value deals. So I think a lot of developers and house builders are actually just kind of watching to see how these schemes are doing and whether they're successful. And then we might see a few more of them come onto the market.
Well, let's hope so. And we'll keep an eye on them as well and report back on the show. Tanya, thanks very much for that. And for more on the types of new build property that are proving attractive, look out for Tanya's analysis in the Money section of this weekend's FT. But that's all for this week's FT Money Show. Remember, you'll find weekday news updates and all of these stories on our website, ft.com/money. And if you have a question that you'd like us to answer about any aspect of your finances, just email us. We will answer your questions or get financial experts to do so on the Reader's Questions page of FT Money. It's a free service and anonymous, so just send your questions in by email to money@ft.com. Next week, we'll bring you another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Alice, Tanya, and our special studio guest, Claire Barrett of Investors Chronicle.
Goodbye.
Bye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organisations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.